Suncast is brought to you by SunGrow, providing clean power for all. Suncast is also brought to you by Trina Solar.
In order to meet our energy transition goals, we have to develop land the size of like Wyoming and Colorado combined. And our current ways of finding land to build on and getting it permitted just takes way too long, is very archaic and incredibly risky. The Brookings Institute, Wall Street Journal, the White House have all cited permitting as one of the biggest bottlenecks to the energy transition. And that is the problem we're here to solve.
Hey there, solar warriors. I'm Nico Johnson, and this is Suncast. Each week, I pull back the veil on the life and business insights of clean tech entrepreneurs building the most noble and impactful companies of our time. I hope what you learn from this conversation is a catalyst for your own growth. So thanks for tuning in and welcome to our tribe. Welcome back, Solar Warriors. I just want to say if you're new here, welcome in. Thank you for giving us the only non-renewable resource you've got. Of course, that is your time and the attention that you give for the next 60 or so minutes could well make the difference between how you were thinking and how you are thinking about solving problems in your world. So I encourage you, stick around. You will not regret it. Today's entrepreneur is a female CEO who has come to my attention through other podcast interviews that she's done and also through our friends mutually in the PR space who insisted you have got to meet this lady. She is really sharp on the topic that she wants to talk about. So Robin Lane, as the CEO and co-founder of Transect, has spent the last 15 plus years managing natural resources, compliance, permitting, you name it. If it has to do with environmental compliance, environmental resources, she's probably touched it. She worked for one of the larger agencies in the U.S. on projects across the entire country, dealing with navigating federal, state, and local permitting for clients. And in that, she discovered that there was a distinct lack of application of tech to solving these problems, to filtering out the data that customers were asking for in a high-tech way that could accelerate things that often would take days, weeks, months into minutes or seconds. Today, we're going to dig into why and how that idea came to this biologist and her team, why she decided to change her stripes from environmental consulting to solving problems for us in the solar industry, and how it might benefit you as well. Automations and renewables, more specifically for solar permitting, are becoming more popular, but they certainly weren't when Robin and her team set out to build Transect. Hey, if you have not subscribed to Suncast yet, I just want to remind you that when you subscribe, the operating system of your choice does its magic. It sends you a little notification every time one of our twice a week episodes come across the transom. The first would be on Tuesdays, which is tactical and practical advice to help guide you through your career, your business decisions. And the second is going to be on Thursdays, like today, episodes with leaders that are on the front lines of the clean energy transition. We've done nearly 700 such episodes now, and I would encourage you to dig into the backstory, but that's not why you're here right now. You're here to dig into this story. So let's get ready to tune up your skills, Solar Warrior, as we tune into another powerful conversation here on Suncast. Well, Robin, it's good to see you again. And I must say, I'm really interested and excited about leaning into this conversation because your story has some interesting twists and turns that I hope we'll dig into. Welcome.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
Fantastic. I trust when a mentor like Mike Casey says, you got to meet this person, that he is not far off from guiding me in the right direction. Mike and I joust at one another, but he definitely chooses his introductions wisely. So I'm grateful for the opportunity to meet you. And I'll kick off as I usually have been prone to do, which is with a quote that I find expiring. A quote that I find inspiring that never expires because it's wisdom from the edges. This one, in fact, is from Seneca. No man was ever wise by chance. And I like that because it implies that to be wise, you have to be intentional. Mm-hmm. And, very few entrepreneurs are successful by chance, right? So I'd love to know if there are any quotes that similarly inspire you, or if you, like me, have quotes up on the wall that you regularly tell folks about?
Yeah. In fact, I think it's probably not a coincidence that mine is also very action-oriented and is about taking initiative. One of my very favorite quotes, they say it's a Chinese proverb. I think it's been around for a long time, so who really knows where it came from. But the best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago, and the second best time to plant a tree is today, which is really about if you want to do something great, start now. And that is that's certainly inspiring as an entrepreneur and suggests we got to get off center and make action.
Very true. Well, part of taking action and getting off center is really understanding where problems are that can be solved. I'd love it if you could describe at a 30,000 foot level the way that you would perhaps at a Christmas party when somebody who has no idea what industry you're in and no even idea of the name of your company, how do you describe the problem that you're trying to solve?
Yeah, I think everyone is very aware of climate change and the energy transition. What not everyone is aware of is that we are struggling to meet our energy transition goals. One of those big barriers to clean energy transition is building solar, building wind, building transmission. The permitting implications around getting those projects successfully built have been shown to be one of the most deadly problems to the energy transition. In order to meet our energy transition goals, we have to develop land the size of, like, I don't know, I've heard of different states, but Wyoming and Colorado combined. And our current ways of finding land to build on and getting it permitted just takes way too long, is very archaic and incredibly risky. The Brookings Institute, Wall Street Journal, the White House have all cited permitting as one of the biggest bottlenecks to the energy transition. And that, you know, is the problem we're here to solve.
That's amazing. Well, with that context in mind, and I really appreciate that you bring in the heavy hitters like the White House and the Brookings Institute to underscore the importance. It's very true and salient that while it used to be, I've been talking a lot about this with friends in the development space. It used to be over the last maybe 3 or 4 or 5 years, interconnection queues were the death knell of whether a project was going to live or die. But in a world where interconnection issues are getting sorted out, NIMBYism is rising, and just finding the, you know, co-locating assets close to the load or close to an available node or interconnection point, and then knowing how to get through the permitting process once you've selected that land can be incredibly complex. And it's often like, which end of the problem do I want to start with? So with that in mind, introduce us to Transect and how you've built Transect to solve this problem that you've just enunciated.
So Transect is a site assessment platform for renewable energy developers. We have ultimately reduced that site assessment timeline from weeks down to minutes. The magic behind our platform is a combination of 1,000+ public and proprietary data sets combined with 75+ years of consulting intelligence that really helps the renewable developers to find and assess the right site to build on very, very quickly. We have a few features that help them do this. We have a Zillow-like parcel filtering tool that helps developers who don't know where they want to build find the right site to build on. You know, you mentioned some of the other problems facing the industry. We do have an AI-driven tool called Solar Pulse that actually uses AI to predict community sentiment and NIMBYism. We have permit requirements and timelines, buildable area calculations, and we operate across the U.S. And we have a marketplace to help customers then find third parties who can help them solve some of these problems. And so we're really kind of that site assessment platform for renewable energy developers, emphasis on environmental, but we're also helping solve some of those other problems that our solar developers, our renewable developers face as well.
So I think one of the things you and I talked about this on our first occasion of meeting, there are a lot of folks looking at, so if you think about project development and in particular permitting and site selection as an elephant, some folks are holding on to the trunk, others are holding on to the tail, the tusk. They're calling the elephant a tail or a tusk or a trunk, right? When it's kind of like the way Baha'i describes faith, And so it can be confusing for a developer listening to be able to differentiate or distinguish. Maybe we just get that one out of the way up front. There are other companies like LandGate and Anderson Optimization who, on the surface, one might assume do the same thing as Transact. And I'm sure that in certain ways you do compete with them. But how would you differentiate the business model that you have from other peers or competitors in the space?
Yeah, I think the emphasis on the land constraints from the environmental and permitting perspective is our vertical. We're very familiar with Anderson Optimization, and they're doing amazing things over there. From what I understand, they're very focused on kind of the physics of the market and connecting to the grid and things like that. And right now, our focus is really on that land constraints and permitting, as well as helping our customers address the next steps, not just identifying the issue, but actually connecting them with service providers that can then solve the problem for them. So that market piece is an important distinction as well.
That's a really interesting point as well. And I want to just key in on the fact that it's really around the environmental attributes of the property. You know, everyone's familiar with projects in the middle of the desert getting stopped because the desert, the tortoise or the hare have been identified, and you have to come up with, if you didn't already identify it, a mitigation plan. And Lord help you if your construction crew is already out there, and as you're digging, you start to find ceremonial relics,
right?
Things of that nature. So what solutions exist for developers today? We mentioned a couple, but if we could think just pragmatically about the infrastructure at the time that you were creating Transact, and what solutions were around?
So big picture, manual collection was the old way to do it. Manual collection of dozens of legal requirements, legal documents, GIS data sources. And who did that collection varied in the past. It could have been maybe someone in-house who was kind of trying to DIY it at a development shop, maybe an environmental consultant like I was in my past. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, it all revolved around someone doing hours of data collection. And that is, you know, what needed to be true for Transact to be possible is back when we started this, kind of an R&D 7 years ago, there started to become kind of a baseline of online data from governmental agencies that we could start from. If the governmental agencies weren't taking the time to use GIS applications and online portals and these kinds of things to make their information more publicly available, it would have been harder to build tools like Transact. And I think that that was something that was true 7 years ago when we started and continues to be more true.
What was the impetus for this kind of open infrastructure at the government level, which was traditionally just paper-based? What was the impetus for that? Do you recall?
I think it probably paralleled the rise of tools like Esri, which is an amazing mapping tool. It's a great tool. I think started by a married couple out of the Pacific Northwest, I think.
And it's called Esri,
ESRI.
I'll go look it up while you talk about it.
It's called ArcMap.
You describe it now. ArcMap. Oh, so Esri is ArcMap.
Yes. Yeah, yeah. If you've heard of ArcMap. I think that, you know, we use ArcMap in consulting. And even before I started Transact in my 15 years, the use of ArcMap was growing in popularity. And, you know, I don't know the Esri folks, but I'll give them a free plug. It's a great platform. You know, the use of that was growing. And I think that simultaneously that was growing in government agencies. I know that they were giving away free subscriptions to universities and government agencies as part of their, I believe that's what I've heard, as part of their strategy. And so probably as the use of Esri or ArcMap and the use of shapefiles became more industry standard, governments realized that they could also make, you know, as they digitize their data, they should be making that publicly available.
Hey, if you're looking for a way to maximize the ROI for your next utility project, I would like to point you to Sungrow's new SG4400 modular inverter. This new innovative solution will reduce capital and operating expenses because it arrives already on a skid with a step-up transformer. It's built using four 1100 kW modules so that if one of them fails, well, the other three keep powering right on through, as the DC and AC protection are completely separate between the modules. You can learn more about this fantastic new product and more at mysuncast.com/sungrow.
When I started in the solar industry, we were very much still in a 2D world. I remember one of my colleagues across, sort of office mates at my first project development role in solar, started geeking out on this thing called Google Earth.
And that's right.
It may as well have been like we were looking over the shoulder of someone at Hogwarts at that time, because it was like, wait a minute, there's the whole, like, the actual globe, like Rand Manalik.
What is this sorcery?
Is out of a job, right? Like, these people are, and he was so excited about this spatial software that, I mean, he came out of a land surveying career. Mm-hmm. And he's like, I don't think people appreciate how this is democratizing access to information. And sure enough, you know, we started maybe a couple of years earlier than that, we had used Google SketchUp for starting to create 3D renderings of projects. And now with Google Earth, we could take those SketchUp models or renderings and we could drop them literally on the roof of a building and show a homeowner. I remember right. The first time I went to, I mean, this is completely different from Transact, but I'm just trying to put people in the perspective of like 2009. I went to a city project bid where they open the bids, right? Like, this is back in, like, they probably still do this, but they like open all the packages, those read through them. And so we'd all show up because I want to know what Chevron and Solar City and everyone else was doing. And they're public documents as soon as those things are open. And we'd go file through them and take pictures of them and all that, right? And the Solar City document had a 3D rendering of a building in the space on the map with the modules on the rooftop, 3D building. And they won the award. And I asked the guy why they won. And he said, well, apart from everything else, like all else being equal, it just looks like Solar City knows what they're doing. Right? Like,
I love that.
They showed us exactly what it's going to look like.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's amazing. I just Googled it. I Googled it. When did Google Maps come out? It came out in 2005. Mm-hmm. And so that's about right. Yeah. You know, I started Transect in 2017. So about a decade of kind of growing in this world of ArcMap and Google Maps and, mm-hmm. and to use your term, democratization of being able to view information digitally, that it had that not happened, platforms like Transect would not be around or useful.
I love that you asked the question, for me of what needed to be true for it to work? Because I'll often ask that question. It really is a fundamental truth of like, okay, well, especially with software and technology, there's a gap between aspiration to leverage a technology and capacity for the marketplace to utilize it. In that regard, the landscape for development is changing. So mm-hmm. I'm curious, now that you have found product market fit, that you've raised money, that you've got a working product out, your kids in school, right? They're out walking around the world. You watch them grow. Who finds Transact's products most useful? Who are your customers and what problems do you solve for them?
The overwhelming majority of our customers are renewable energy developers. That's utility scale solar, community scale solar, battery storage, and wind. They are the ones that are currently competing in this land race for where to build more power generating mm-hmm. projects. And so we are helping them solve this problem of all of the easy sites are taken at this point in time. And they're having to be strategic about where they're contacting landowners. You know, how ahead of time are they tying up sites? Are they leasing and holding? You know, how are they spending their money? And our platform is helping them intelligently make decisions about which sites they should prioritize, going from a list of 50 potential sites down to 3 and really being able to compete more competitively in that land race.
A lot of folks maybe haven't heard of your company, but you've had what I would consider to be tremendous success over the last, certainly over the last 4 or 5 years, once getting that, you know, signature clients and developing the product around what they give you feedback on. What would you consider to be some of the major milestones that your investors and your customers are excited about?
I think our traction in the renewable energy space is something I'm really proud of. Like I said, a majority of our customers are in the renewable energy space. Mm-hmm. We've got 200 plus or something at this point in time. And that feels really good to be able to help that many customers solve these kind of landscape level problems that they have. On the business building side, I built this company for 2 main reasons, and anyone on my team or ask me about my mission would hear me say this. I wanted to solve the problems around the relationship between the built world and the natural world, and I wanted to create a company where people want to work. And so I think a couple of other, you know, metrics about our team and about our company is that we are Series A venture backed. So we have achieved that milestone in the venture world of catching the eye of some really amazing investors.
Yeah.
And we have a team of full-time employees, 31 or 32. We just hired a few more this week with about another 10 or so offshore. So a large team that we're supporting with. And, you know, my personal happy metric is that I survey our team once a month for their net promoter score. Would they suggest a colleague to come work at Transect? And we have a very high net promoter score, the highest we've ever had in our company history right now. And I'm personally very proud of that. So that feels good to me as a company owner.
That's amazing. I haven't been able to find any information, neither about how much you raised nor who the fantastic investors are. What can you share?
So we don't share how much we've raised publicly, but any investor is welcome to reach out to me to learn more. Some of our kind of biggest investors, our seed round investor was Blue Bear Capital out of LA, which is an amazing climate investor. We've also had subsequent investors at our Series A's at Pinebrook Partners out of New York. Bentley Systems is one of our biggest investors. And then we do have a large corporate venture arm of a large renewable energy company that I have said I cannot say their name online. But we have one of our bigger clients also has a venture arm who's an investor in Transect.
How long has it been since you raised your Series A?
We closed our Series A in the spring of 2022.
Okay. So it's been a minute. What was the immediate impact of raising venture capital?
Well, that would have been the second round of venture capital that we raised, because we raised our seed round, and we closed the week we all got sent home from COVID.
No way.
And so yeah. I know we talked a little bit about like the difference between skill and luck at the beginning of the podcast.
Yeah.
That was probably a bit of a luck moment because we were able to use that time of COVID to build our remote business, make a lot of strategic decisions because we were freshly recapitalized. And so I really think it's been team growth is such an important part of the business. The majority of where our spend, our operational expenses, is on people. And so there certainly becomes a turning point in company history where you can hire who you can hire.
Yeah.
And then where you can start hiring to scale.
Yeah,
and I think that is the biggest impact that venture dollars has.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah.
There's a lot of constraint in hiring. And there's always this tepid moment that you see when anybody talks about their capacity to hire prior to VC, because you don't want ever to insinuate that you hired people that were only the people you could hire.
Right.
They were the only ones you could get to, right? Because you couldn't hire the good ones. what it really means is that like it takes a certain kind of person to commit to a startup pre-seed.
It does.
And those people have a different heart. And there are a category of individuals who are absolutely like instrumental in scaling a company, who have absolutely zero tolerance or risk tolerance for early stage pre-venture. And you just can't hire them. Like they won't take the risk.
That's right.
And
yeah.
That's exactly right. It's an important distinction because and it's at that level that the people that you hire early on that have the heart, but not necessarily the skill or the pattern matching, right? It's like if you've been there, then you can help a company accelerate quickly. And that's what Series A money helps you do, is bring those people in that aren't any better than your existing team, except that they have been there, done that, and they can identify problems faster. They can find pathways to success quicker. They can show you where you've potentially made mistakes that your internal team never saw or didn't know to address. And it's a really critical juncture for.
Yeah, that's exactly right.
Especially for a software company.
Yeah. We call that distinction like the 0 to 1 people and then the 1 to 10 people. Mm. They both have amazing skill sets.
Yeah.
But there comes a time transition and,
use the term recapitalized and, one of the funny, interesting parts of how you guys built the business is it's a little counterintuitive. How much did you as co-founders invest, and maybe put into context around recapitalization for you? for the business?
So yeah, before we raised our Series C and Series A, before we went proper venture, we actually went kind of a bit more of like a bootstrapped friends and family route at first. So we raised a couple rounds of convertible notes from friends and family and from some small angel investors. And that actually got us through, I think, about 2.5 years that was largely R&D. Had a lot of people that really believed in our vision. We definitely raised all that money on a vision and on hope. And on our past business capabilities. I mean, there were three original co-founders, and all of us had very different and very useful skill sets. And so we were able to raise kind of with an idea, this funding. And so, once we got our first, cohort of customers and started to get some product market fit and some traction, we attracted our first venture investor. In fact, we didn't even go out to market. The three founders were actually opposed to raising venture money. We were like, we're going to bootstrap this thing. We're going to make it profitable. And then when we were approached by Blue Bear, an absolutely amazing venture fund that any portfolio company would be lucky to be on their team. We realized the benefits of venture. I'd never raised venture funding before. I didn't even know what I was doing, right? But we realized the benefits, and that's the route we ended up taking. But yes, we were definitely existing on a lot of good faith from a lot of friends and family and smaller angel groups for a couple
years. Tremendous. The friends and family round, how did you know how to structure that?
That's a great question. So one of my original co-founders has a business finance and accounting background. So that was definitely helpful. I, as myself, would not have known how to do that, but he understood pro formas and how to put together a plan and revenue projections, right? An offset of operations and expenses versus revenue. And we had to combine that, though, with proving early traction, which was one of the things that I did that was really practical, was going to some of my previous clients and saying, I'm thinking about building this tool called Transect that does site assessment in minutes instead of weeks. Would you buy it? And how much would you buy it for? And that information had to go into the pro forma to ultimately convince any early investor, friends and family or not, that this was a good idea. So I talk about our experience and the goodwill of others, but we had to have some chops behind what we were asking them to put money into. So I think, doing some market research, building an MVP, we proved in a hot tub, actually, the three of us, that we could draw a line on a map and then have a program tell us something interesting about that line. So with MVP, early kind of validation from big major players in the developer space in a couple different industries.
And these presumably
early
were all
idea
your customers.
On pricing.
They were like most of your customers from your consulting, your
that's
day
right.
job.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. That's
right.
That's
super helpful. It's probably fair to say that every sector in the U.S. solar industry is anticipating the emergence of truly domestic U.S. module manufacturing capacity over the coming years. But for Trina Solar's customers, that wait is over, as the new 5-gigawatt facility in Wilmer, Texas, will soon have U.S.-made N-type TOPCon modules rolling off the line, all while supporting 1,500 local jobs. Just another reason Trina Solar is your trusted partner for Total Solar Solutions. Visit mysuncast.com/Trina to learn more about Trina U.S. manufacturing capacity. Hey, pardon the interruption, but I wanted to just let you know how much of an impact you have on Suncast. Yeah, you. Thank you for clicking play. Without you, this show is just me shouting into the void. But there's still people who don't even know about Suncast. I know, I can hardly believe it myself. But that's where you can help me yet again. There's a simple way that you can show some love and help others discover the show. If you cruise over to www.ratethispodcast.com/Suncast, I'd love it if you would leave a 5-star rating and enthusiastic review. That's possibly the single kindest thing that you could do for me today. So if the show has helped, inspired, or even entertained you at all, I'd love it if you would head over to ratethispodcast.com/suncast and give me a virtual 2 thumbs up. All right, back to today's episode. you mentioned that you're in Central Texas. You grew up in Central Texas. Could you give me a sense of what was the conversation like around the dinner table as a kid? Were you in a particularly entrepreneurial family or environment? Was there anything that would have suggested that this might be the direction you'd take your career?
Yeah. I grew up in a very middle-class Austin before it was cool Austin. I'm a unicorn that was originally born in very close to downtown Austin, and my parents still live there.
Yeah.
I think the important thing about my home life growing up, my parents weren't particularly entrepreneurial. My dad worked for the state, but my mom had to reinvent herself in the early 80s as a stockbroker.
Whoa.
She was a teacher and she reinvented herself as a stockbroker. And so she was like the only female in a bullpen full of men, because that was a very male dominated industry at the time. Still probably is, but even more so back then, kind of like scrounging for business and trying to build her book of business. And so the talk around the dinner table was always the business challenges that my mom was struggling through and the different relationships that she had and the different, you know, colleagues. Men that were either supporting her or not, you know, being less productive. And so that's a lot of what I grew up with, was watching my mom with the day in and day out struggles of balancing being a mom and being a financial planner. And she retired a few years ago as a very successful financial planner. And I've always looked up to her as a role model. And she really taught me about drive and determination and in a pretty cutthroat space. And that certainly reflected in my career and in my choice to kind of set out something that requires quite a bit of grit Metal. And determination.
Yeah. Apart from your mother and perhaps close family, any personal heroes that stand out from the early life?
From my early life, before I started working, I think my mom was it. Like, she just taught me so much about being a working woman and and the challenges that come along with being in a male dominated industry. I think I got some more role models further along in my career, but early on, she was it.
Is there any particular career path that you always thought you would go down, but ended up veering away from?
I don't know when I decided I absolutely loved the outdoors. You know, around the kitchen table, we did always bird watch. And my mom gardened. And so we were, you know, I always had those. And those are definitely still hobbies I have today. And they probably spurred a lot of my interest in studying ecology, which was ultimately my degree. There was a time in college where I got an internship and therefore thought I wanted to be for the rest of my life a zookeeper. So I was a zookeeper for a time
party fact.
In college. It is my fun party fact. That and that I did a stint as an adult tap dancer. Those are my two party facts. don't ask me to do it on camera. I can't tap dance on camera. There was a time where I thought zookeeping might be the place I would like to go. When I think about my retirement job someday, I would love to be a volunteer at the zoo, because it's still one of my favorite places to be. But it was a really cool time, but didn't make sense from a career path.
I love it. Adult tap dancer. That is another. So now what's true is someone, thanks to this interview, will come up to you at a trade show or a party and be like, so tap dancing? Fantastic. Well, I'm sure you realize that zookeeping probably wasn't going to get you to the kind of retirement that your mother was enjoying.
That's exactly right.
And so you switched to environmental consulting. What was the underlying, sort of driver for that, explain why being in Central Texas is kind of like the nexus for anyone that wants to be in environmental consulting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. So I graduated from college and didn't really know what environmental consulting was. That was not a career path presented to me, but as all college graduates do, my resume got handed around and I kind of fell into consulting. And falling into it in the Central Texas area is an amazing place to do it, because we have one of the highest concentrations of urban endangered species in Central Texas, outside of somewhere like California, Carlsbad, California, I think. And so we have a lot of local regulation. We have a lot of state regulation. And of course, we have federal regulation. And so there's a lot of a lot of very interesting field work going on around here. I learned very quickly about all sorts of endangered species. I'm a permitted golden cheek warbler biologist. I scaled down caves to look for salamanders. I, you know, got in a helicopter and looked for bald eagles. Like, it's a very cool place to do environmental work. And we learned a lot because we do have so many layers of regulation. The city of Austin and San Antonio and then the TCEQ all have a lot of protections around those resources as well. That's not true in states like up through North Dakota, like Oklahoma and Kansas. There's less kind of regulatory burden to learn how to navigate. So it was a great place to cut my teeth.
Well, then you decided at some point to transition into maybe consulting isn't the right word, but you started to see opportunity to take the skills you've been developing and apply them in more than the day job, right? This the nugget of an idea that maybe what I'm learning can apply to more than just the customers I'm serving at this company. Could you take me to that point in time where you've kind of become so good at something that those who have hired you have asked you to manage others, you are starting to notice as a manager, not only are there inefficiencies in the company, but in the industry. Kind of take me to that genesis moment for it.
Yeah, you're exactly on point. Somehow when you're really good at something, people decide to put you in charge of other people to do that thing, right? And so you end up managing, I ended up as a national program manager, managing a whole bunch of consultants like me, and really realizing a lot of the inefficiencies in industry. The ways that we did things had not changed much at all since the 1970s with the passage of the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act and the National Environmental Policy Act. And back to our earlier conversation, we were starting to see more and more public data come online, more applications of ArcMap. Google Earth was definitely taking off. We were starting to see much more use of the KML type file, the .KML file. It was also coincided with, I think that was 2012, 2014, somewhere in there, when we were having a similar land race in traditional energy, in midstream. Mm-hmm. With the introduction of fracking, we had a massive explosion in needing to transport natural gas and oil across this country. And so we were similarly having my clients call and say, I want to build this thing tomorrow. Can you tell me what all the things I need to know? Right. And so we were behind, we had inefficiencies, we were doing a lot of copying and pasting. It was error prone. And then it was like, there's gotta be a better way to reproduce this. We're doing the same research every time, just in maybe a slightly different area with a slightly different iteration, and producing this PDF report that's then static. What if they decide to make some small change to the footprint of the project, then that report may no longer be relevant. And so that's really where in this land race, this first land race that I was in about 10 years ago, started to see, like, there's got to be a way that we can take the consultant brain and put it in a platform and use all these emerging tools to build a way to do this desktop sites assessment much faster than this old archaic way that we're doing it. And if we can do that, what other parts of this process can we find ways to make faster and make better with technology?
There's a big difference between identifying inefficiencies, recognizing that within the safety of this nest called a job, 401k, a steady salary, people to talk to day to day that may or may not understand what you are identifying as problem. And then going, I'm not satisfied and we're fulfilled and I can do this better. So maybe to go back to something you said earlier, take me to the hot tub moment, because you've mentioned co-founders and we know that you're the CEO, but take me to that hot tub moment where you realized we could create something, even if it's an MVP format, that probably even our current employers would hire us to do.
Yeah, I'll take us back even to pre-hot tub moment, which was just the, is this even a viable idea moment? Yeah. And that is when we started to talk, and you know, I was, full disclosure, I was respectful of the company I was working for at the time. And I was not attempting to like poach or be weird about our existing clients. So I was trying, I had a long history of clients and I tended to use old clients, but we really wanted to get some validation from them that this is a product they would be interested in purchasing. And so even before we said, can we do it? We said, should we do it? And getting that early validation, like I was talking about earlier, was really key to then figure out, okay, what what would they want? As a consultant, how can I, my goal is always to make sure that whatever Transect produces is 10 is better than, and preferably 10x better than the current solution.
Yeah.
And so once we kind of identified what they would pay for it, what their problem is in a different order, right? What their problem is and how much they would pay to have that problem solved. Then we could start ideating on what kind of the user experience would look like. And that took us to the hot tub where I did have two original co-founders, which were amazing, and they've both moved on to other things. But we did have an original CTO who was a wonderful self-taught engineer who, and we all sat in our hot, my hot tub at the time and watched him code and do his magic. And, it was an exciting moment when it worked.
I'm having a hard time imagining this. Watched him code like computer on the side of the hot tub.
Yep.
Holy
literally. Son. Like, that's I think weird. We each had a cocktail and he just literally had his laptop in the hot tub with a towel underneath it. So no water would soak up.
Course,
and he was just, coding in the hot tub.
Were you guys all employees in the same company?
We were not. No. Mm. We all worked at separate places. We knew each other from college.
From college, not even friends in the industry. It was just like, Robin has a problem. We can help fix it.
That's right. Yeah. Cool. Yeah. We had all kept in touch since college, and we knew we had complementary skill sets to building this platform. And at the time where all of our careers were, it kind of made sense to focus on this for a time.
So when did you know that you could go all in on this idea?
Two times. One is we set ourselves a fundraising goal. And this is also, lawyer advice. If you're going to raise a convertible note, you have to raise a certain percentage of that convertible note for it to be real, right? Mm-hmm. And so if we could hit a fundraising mark that would make it comfortable for at least two of the three of us to quit our full-time jobs, we felt like logistically that was the right time. We had enough people that believed in this idea that was validation that we should go all in. I think we'd already quit our full-time jobs when we got, because we were in R&D for 2 years. I think when I realized that this had real potential was when we closed one of our first clients, which I don't think I'm allowed to say their name, but it was a huge traditional energy company. We walked up to their CEO at a conference and literally where they were having issues with like some wetlands, and we showed them our phone and said, "Is this your project? Transect would have found this for you." And he basically said, "Did you just run that?" We said, "Yes." He said, "Call these people," and they signed like a $80,000 contract like 3 days later. And we're like, "Oh my God, we're going to be billionaires." So of course there's the marketing bell curve, and we had some early adopters that saw the excitement in the technology, and sales and marketing gets harder from there. But that was when we felt like we were onto something.
The marketing bell curve, for anybody unfamiliar, would you want to take a crack at explaining that one?
I'm not a marketing person, but I've been told it enough from my marketing team that I'll try to make a run at it. So the idea is that with the y-axis being maybe volume of the market, like the volume of customers that you could sell to, and the x-axis being time, that early on in a stage like ours, there are few customers, but that are very willing to purchase. They're called the early innovators. Mm-hmm. They're the ones that are oftentimes lining up around the store for the iPhone. They're the ones that think technology will give them a competitive advantage. There may not be a ton of them, but they're very willing to pay sometimes ridiculous prices for your technology because they think it's really going to give them an up. As you move down in time, you get into things like the early adopters, which oftentimes are still really interested in technology, but they want to see more traction. They want to see case studies. They want to see logos. They want to like have you prove the market a little bit more. And oftentimes they're a little bit more cost conscious. And so I think that's true of every tech company, is you kind of get those early adopters that are the early innovators that absolutely love your tech and think it's amazing and the next big thing, and we love them. And they also help build the product a lot. They give a lot of customer feedback. They're really involved. And then you start selling to like kind of the masses, and they often need a little bit more convincing.
Yeah. We've talked at length on the show about crossing the chasm A fantastic book that I think everyone should read. Anybody building a business, anybody working in early stage business. Jeffrey Moore wrote a book a while ago, I think maybe 10 years ago now, called Crossing the Chasm. We did a whole series with Omnidian that I would point folks to on the future of solar. And we talked about crossing the chasm in detail. So I would encourage folks to go listen to that. But effectively, marketing bell curve, among the many ways that folks have tried to sort of parse it, does deal with this early innovator, early adopter, early majority, late majority, like how and when people adopt the technology and why. And there's a high enthusiasm, low adoption early in the cycle. And it often cues entrepreneurs to have a higher sense of confidence in projections because of the marketing bell curve.
That's right.
With that in mind, yeah, given that you had, you know, a couple of big companies early on, I imagine that you also ran into just customer delivery issues and customer like assumption challenges. I'm curious, what in the early stages, first year or two, were the challenges you ran into? What assumptions did you have to address, et cetera?
I think one of the hardest lessons we learned early on was about customer success and customer care and delighting our customer. We relied too heavily at first with a very small team, not knowing how to run a tech company at first, on our product making contracts sticky in and of itself. And one of the first big contracts that we won in those first few months of going to market, we lost after a year, which hurt a lot when you only have a handful of customers, because we never called them. We didn't make sure that they knew how to use the platform. We didn't train them how to use the platform. We just thought that they were figuring it out.
Right.
And that was, looking back, it feels like such an obvious lesson. But, you know, we were running in 100 different directions trying to build the business, and we just lost sight of making of customer delight. And that is a hard lesson that we learned. And these days, customer delight is always one of our pillars in our growth strategy for the year. Being customer obsessed is a lingering pillar of, you know, in our rocks or KPIs or OKRs, whatever your listenership calls them. We have our version here, and customer success and obsession is, we never lose sight of that now. That was a hard lesson to learn.
It's a hard lesson. And I ask because I want folks who are considering entrepreneur or entrepreneurship to recognize that they can learn from your mistakes. You can start a business by knowing that you should not go 6 months or a year without asking your customer for feedback or without designing a customer onboarding process. And they're not intuitive. It's not something there's, I mean, there are probably books for it now, but like when Robin and I were starting our companies 8 years ago, there weren't a lot of books out there that would guide you. And if they were, we weren't coming from the kind of, I would say, pedigree of people that would be like, hey, here, you should be reading this. Have you thought about that? So surround yourself with smart people. In the meantime, listen to Suncast. I'm curious, what did you learn in the early days of growing the team in the process, that 2 years of getting to product market fit? And it might be, maybe it was longer than 2 years to get a product market fit, because it took 2 years to just get the product out in the hands of customers.
Yeah. We had some early wins in those first couple years to just kind of prove that we were on track, but we really didn't go fully to market. It really kind of goes back to the 0 to 1. We really had to find the right team to, and this feels obvious, to solve the right problem at the time, but we did have to prioritize because we didn't have much of a budget. So I think the first key roles we hired for was like a sales guy, a data person, and kind of a cross-functional role of operations slash someone who was from my industry, an environmental person, who could take on some of the burden of the environmental development, which I was entirely doing
myself.
It could
be another subject matter expert.
I needed another subject matter expert. And so I think those were, and then I think honestly the third or fourth hire we made was a customer success person. So we just really had to pick and choose what was important, and, you know, find that 0 to 1 person who could be scrappy. And later on, we learned, you know, more lessons about hiring, and we have a much more sophisticated culture first hiring process now. But yeah, we just needed to find scrappy people.
Yeah. Can you teach me some of the culture first hiring practices?
Sure. So this actually came out of, you know, when I think about later stages of building a team and what it's taken to get from a team of four or five to a team of 30, you know, full transparency. I think there is a misconception about, at least there was, maybe it's more clear now, but when I was building this in the first few years, there's a misconception about what good culture was. And it was like, cool, I've got unlimited PTO and a cool office, because this was pre-COVID, right? Like, I'm done with culture, you know? And that is not true. As we've gotten bigger, about a year and a half or so ago, let culture get away from me as a priority, and learned from some employee feedback that about half the company was like getting ready to leave.
Wow.
And
holy
because
smokes.
We had made some hiring decisions, going back to the hiring thing, we'd made some hiring decisions that didn't make sense for our culture and for our team. And lovely human beings.
Very politically just correct.
Lovely human beings, just a mismatch on culture. And that's okay. And so we had to make some hard changes to address that. And then we redid our core values. We got some of the kind of the staff involved in developing our core values, so they weren't top down. We also at that time started following an operational methodology called EOS, the Entrepreneurial Operating System, Gina Wickman's book Traction. And they have a concept in there about right person, right seat, that has a qualifications and a culture fit assessment. And so nowadays when we hire, we're a bit more particular about making sure that everyone, all stakeholders, whether they work for them, with them, beside them, above them, agree that they're a culture fit and that they have the right skill set. Because again, like we talked about earlier, now that we have venture money, we can we're looking for a different kind of skill set around scaling. We're still scrappy. One of our pillars is be scrappy, because we are still a bit in startup mode. But we also have to consider the balance of scaling.
So you mentioned EOS. At what stage would you suggest other founders start to think about installing an operating system in that manner?
I wish I had done it a bit earlier, because I think one of the most important elements of Traction, or of any EOS, or of any operating system that you choose, is the vision planning and the transparency with the team, as well as like the cadence of goal setting.
Yeah.
Before we did EOS, we did OKRs, which a lot of tech companies do. And that was helpful to get us quarter to quarter, but it didn't have the full interaction or kind of the full implementation of how like the 3 and the 10 year goal setting for your company is influenced by core values and by the accountability chart, who owns what, which I think is really important at an early stage when everybody's kind of a jack of all trades. And then, you know, making sure that we're not all just rowing, we're rowing in the same direction.
Yeah.
I wish we would have implemented it a little bit earlier, because we had to do a lot of work to get it implemented and change quite a few processes.
Yeah. How early? As early as possible. But at what point is it a misuse of time? I firmly believe that there's a too early for something like EOS.
I think when you're coming up on at least 10 people, I think you got to start implementing an operating system, because that's when you start having like 2 or 3 person conversations a little bit more. As you start having people reporting to people, you might have somewhere like maybe 1 or 2 manager types. Like I think one of the important elements of an EOS is communication across the company. Yeah. And I think when you start getting 10 plus, you start it's hard to keep track of everything on Slack at that point in time.
You eventually had to zero in on a sector, because you mentioned some of your early clients were oil and gas, traditional energy. At what point did solar come into to sort of zero in as the center of the crosshairs for you?
This was really market conditions. I talked earlier about how we raised our seed round the week that we all got sent home from COVID.
Yeah.
Because of COVID, the markets in real estate and traditional energy really got put on pause. And at that same time, the narrative around climate change really got very loud.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually happened to be doing some market research with some old colleagues, And one of them happened to be at a renewable energy company now doing environmental work. And I called her to ask some kind of market research questions. And she asked what I did. And I told her what I was doing. And she said, that sounds really cool. And they actually ended up signing up. And so that was our first client in renewables. Uh-huh. Was just a phone call I happened to make.
Cool.
And from there, we realized, this, all the market conditions are coming together for this to be the right market to pursue.
Yeah.
And that's continued to be true.
And you had a product ready at that point. Like, you'd already shipped a product mm-hmm. by the time you decided on. So that's super cool.
That's right.
Are you at liberty to say who some of your early developer customers were, like the companies that believed in you that are open about the fact that they're Transite customers?
Yeah. So that first client that we signed up was Recurrent Energy.
Wow. Nice.
I know some of the other early ones that we've talked about in the past were things like Forefront, Origis, Orsted. Wow. So we got some
That's
nice
cool.
logos
some really,
early on.
Some really mm-hmm. like very large stalwart developers, Forefront, mm-hmm. Origis, mm-hmm. Orsted. Those are big names.
Yeah.
So with regards to product market fit, you had a product that you thought would work. You had a colleague at Recurrent who said this would be very interesting for our sector. Talk about that moment where you realized, okay, this is what our investors meant by product market fit. And, or did you have an investor say, okay, you've got product market fit? Because I feel like there's this period where you're not really sure. It's like, I think we did. Do we get it? Is this it? Is this what product market fit looks like? This is like the blue heron that everybody's chasing.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh, I don't know. I might be a contrarian on this one, but I think product market fit can be an illusion at any stage.
Yeah.
Because I don't think there is a time where you obtain product market fit. Maybe if you're Amazon, right? Like if you are a total market domination and there's like nobody else that can compare to you, I think you have product market fit. I think until that time, there will always be reasons why there might be a different product or a better product or something that we could do different. And as long as we are still experimenting and learning with the sales and marketing flywheel about who our ideal customer profile is mm-hmm. and what their problems are and how we can solve that, we're still chasing product market fit, and we can be iterative on it. I don't think there's a moment that we've experienced yet where we're like, yes, we 100% have product market fit. We know we have a product a lot of people will buy, and that's amazing. And we've been able to get a lot of good traction there. But I think taking the eye off of that iteration is probably would be short-sighted.
Is there anything specifically that you find you're continually having to teach others about the terminology to use, or perhaps even that you've created a specific lexicon around to enable your product roadmap or your product sort of marketing?
Interesting. I think, especially early on, and for those who haven't heard of Transect yet, or any of the other kind of GIS-based or database platforms and renewables, the idea of when you say it specifically environmental consulting to any land developer in the past, the thought bubble in their head is a person. Mm-hmm. And we now are trying to convince them that the thought bubble in their head should be this 30-second platform tool that they have. And I don't think there's new language around there to introduce them to, but I think the concept of trusting a platform instead of, you know, the consultant that they have on speed dial has been a challenge and continues to be a challenge for us.
Yeah, I think that's equally important. And I try to emphasize with founders that to the extent that you can, as opposed to thinking, oh, well, I don't want to change the way that they speak about things. Actually, you know, Tim Ferriss points out, like, own a term, create a term if you have to, so that mm-hmm. when they hear, think about, use that term, it always drives home that it relates back to Transact in this case, right?
Mm-hmm.
I think that you are approaching it in a way that suggests that this reinvention of process, maybe there's a, you know, a three word kind of thing, like something over process processes, people powered or people is whatever, something like that is probably something that would anchor your prospects and clients around the way that Transact helped them reimagine utilizing software instead of humans to solve a problem.
Yeah.
Cool.
Yeah, we'd love for like the Transect name to become like Kleenex, right? It's a brand name,
yep.
But it's just it's a generalized term for a mm-hmm. tissue. We started to see on M&A documents where they're sharing due diligence back and forth. There used to be a box for share your environmental reports. We've started to see share your environmental or Transect report now, right? So we'd love to be like that ubiquitous, like any environmental report is just a Transect report now. Right?
I'm going to give you something to switch that with, right? And maybe this was just on the fly, you were thinking about that. But instead of saying Kleenex, PV cyst, right?
So, oh, okay. Yeah.
Because people don't ask for irradiance reports or yield studies. Mm. They ask for your PV cyst files. And if you're a solar module manufacturer, they ask for your PAN file, which is the file they can import into the PV cyst software. And why do they ask for a PAN file? Because they're not going to use SAM or any of the dozen other modeling tools. They're going to use PV cyst because that's what the bank considers to be bankable, right?
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
if Transect can become as ubiquitous in a requirements document as PV cyst is, right? To the point where, like you said earlier, KML and XML files, like what's the Transect file that your developer partners have to include in their data set, right? And that someone doing diligence would say, well, where are the TML files, right?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. We'd love to get there. We're starting to see some early adoption of Transect as a more ubiquitous term.
So that's awesome.
We hope
that.
To keep doing that.
I love that. Was there any advice that you got in the early stage of building the business that really, in reflection, was foundational insight on how you either evolved or built the business or stopped building the business?
This is not advice I got from a person. It was advice I got from a book.
That's perfect.
There's a book called Exponential Organizations. Uh-huh. And I actually mentioned this statistic or this metric earlier on in the podcast. His whole point, the author's whole point, is that everything we do as an organization to be useful has to be exponentially better. So an exponential team, an exponential operational system, an exponential everything. And I think I really took to heart the exponential product piece in finding a way for our product to always be 10x better than the current solution, right? Because otherwise there is no motivation for a customer, a renewable developer, to switch from their current process. And so that's a really high bar I've always held for myself around our data, around how our product works, around customer success, around our team. It's that key metric that sticks in the back of my head. That's like, is this 10x better? Is it 10x better yet? How can we make it 10x better? I think that was really formative in how I've run the company.
Advice from a little known investor known Peter Diamandis. Yeah, that's great. I hadn't heard of exponential organizations. There's the EXO 2.0, which is the new playbook on 10x growth and impact, with a foreword by Ray Kurzweil. This is a great resource. Thank you for sharing that.
Mm-hmm.
Is there anything that you've decided upon introduction of new information that you no longer believed, that you changed your mind on?
I don't know if this is something that I think this applies. I think a mindset that founders could have. I think I had it going into being a startup founder is the type of characteristics that a startup founder should have. I think we idealize people like Mark Zuckerberg and Adam Newman and people like that that are, you know, kind of like the very you know, even like Steve Jobs, right? They're like the very high profile kind of visionary, very odd, kind of like big personality types, very, you know, like my way or the highway. I've got this like strategic vision and you know, we're just going to build what I'm saying, you know. And I felt like I fell into that and also oftentimes like judged myself for not being that. And really over the last couple of years, I've really kind of settled more into what I think is the appropriate role for me as a CEO, at least. And that's really more around listening to my team.
Yeah.
Because I have a limited set of experience. I'm an ecology major, right? He's amazing at environmental consulting, but I'm not great at product. I'm not great at customer success. I'm definitely not great at sales. And so, and my product team and my customer success team, my sales team talks to the customer a lot more than I do now. Mm-hmm. And they understand their pain points a lot better than I do. And so, you know, I think possibly a bit of a contrarian view to what I at least understood of startup CEO is how much I rely on my team to make really good decisions let them drive a lot of the product vision. I, of course, kind of have like, you know, veto power and I kind of have an overall mission, and I filter everything through, does this product match our vision, which is around, you know, finding ways to balance conservation of the natural world with the needs of the built world. So I can own that. But I thought of a startup CEO was supposed to be one way. And I think I figured out it's really more about not, you know, unblocking things, making if there's roadblocks, figure out how to unblock them, making sure we have enough money to keep running the company, and then just being a guide rail and kind of like providing some North Star guidance, but really trusting my team a lot to build a business because they're really, really smart.
Is there anything on your nightstand or anything in particular that has also that you haven't mentioned that's been an impactful resource for you in helping you with entrepreneurship or getting into the solar industry or some other aspect of the business?
I think the one other book that has, well, there's been lots of books that have been really formative, but a very key book for founders that find themselves in my world of raising venture money is a book called Venture Deals by Brad Feld. And it is literally the 101 on term sheets and a liquidation preference and, you know, how to negotiate valuations and all that. It is definitely a venture Bible. And if, you know, if we have some early, you know, thinking about being entrepreneurs on here, that book, I wish I had had that book in my seed round. I did not learn about that book until the A round. So a lot of
I
had to learn a lot.
The A round.
I read it before the A round, but I already learned a lot of it at the seed round, but I had to learn the hard way. And fortunately, our seed round investor is incredibly nice and thoughtful and explained a lot of that to me, right? And it worked out well.
Yeah. For those who are unfamiliar, if you've ever heard of TechStars or the Founder Group or basically venture capital moving outside of Silicon Valley and into like Denver, Boulder area, thank Brad Feld for that and his co-author and longtime cohort, Jason Mendelsohn. Great book. Thank you. That was a great recommendation. And I imagine that many people listening probably haven't heard of it, even though, because we find ourselves in these circles and it was like, how have you not heard of it? But it's still true. Where, if folks are so inclined, I'm sure they will be, could they engage with you? And if we have developers here listening and they want to try Transect out, where can they find that?
They can find me or sign up for demo at transect.com.
Transect.com. Fantastic. Well, let's wrap with a simple question. How will we know that we've gotten it right? We're 20 or 30 years from here, and we're looking back on a successful energy transition that was scaled in large part because we had software solutions like Transect. What did we get right? What bottleneck did we move out of the way?
I think the one thing we still need to get right, that I'm optimistic with a lot of effort we can, is businesses really need to be incentivized to make decisions that benefit climate. Right now, there's a lot of nice to haves around climate, and there's a lot of narrative around, wouldn't it be nice if business did this? But there's not a whole lot of actual teeth incentives. I don't know if those are carrot or stick, financial incentives or like regulations. And I'm typically not like an over-regulatory person, right? So I don't love that one. I've seen the benefit of things like some benefits of things like the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act, right? But there's always red tape involved with all of them. So I hesitate to say regulation is the way to go, but it'd be nice to have some sort of carrot, right? Yeah. Some sort of like drive carrot to help businesses get in line, get on board, or kind of like do more. I'll put it that way, to help businesses do more to help with climate change. It feels like we need to increase the narrative somehow. Like, I feel like we're all, yes, energy transition, but in the day-to-day practicalities, it's hard to implement it.
Robin Lane is the CEO and co-founder of Transect, bringing transformative software to the really hard to develop early greenfield part of building these infrastructure assets around the world. Robin, thank you so much for taking the time out of your busy day to join us here on Suncast. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in all the way to the end. I love our all the way to the end of the episode listeners, because you are truly hungry for more. I hope that this episode delivered as I promised that it would. I feel like Robin really delivered on the fundraising, the early startup advice aspects. Got a lot of great book recommendations. By the way, if you are interested in those books or any of the other resources that I dug up in getting ready for this episode. Well, you can find those at mysuncast.com/episode. Just click on the show notes page for this episode and you'll find all the resources there. It should be linked in the description, whatever app or video player you are using to view this. If you can't find it, email me, nico@mysuncast.com. I'll make sure that you get connected there. Each and every week, I bring rising stars and longtime pioneers in the industry on the front lines of the clean energy transition into your purview so that you can learn from them, so that you can have guidance, mentorship, peer relationships even, with folks that are helping build our clean energy infrastructure, the clean energy economy. Thank you for tuning in, and thanks also to our sponsors who help make sure that each and every week you have a show to tune into by supporting the show financially. So all you got to do is pay attention. If you want to give them a thank you, I would really appreciate it. You can do so by going to mysuncast.com/sponsor. Check out the offers that you've no doubt heard throughout this episode. And that's also how you could find out ways that you could partner with us to reach thousands of solar warriors and climate champions each and every week, twice a week, just like they do. If you are looking for yet another way that you could help support Suncast or thank us for the work that we do, please go to ratethispodcast.com/Suncast and leave us an enthusiastic 5-star review. If you've listened all the way through, you've no doubt enjoyed this episode. You should check out our nearly 700 episodes in the back catalog. They are very full of evergreen content, just like this one, to help you build your business, your career, and help us scale the clean energy infrastructure necessary to, in our own way, help save the planet. Remember, you are what you listen to. Thanks again for showing up, Solar Warrior. It's half the battle.